Time now is 8:05, and that means it's time for this week's live edition of Any Questions. Here in the chair is Jonathan Dimbleby.
Welcome to Formby High School, which of course is in Formby on the coast between Liverpool and Southport. Formby was once a Viking settlement, but is now a dormitory town for its neighbours. It's one of the few places in Britain where you can still find the red squirrel, which inhabit the pine woods along its vast, and when the summer arrives, extremely popular beach for the people of Merseyside. Our panel includes at least one individual who is almost as shy and elusive as the red squirrel. I have in mind, of course, Edwina Curry, who is not to be confused with Charlotte Ramping, although she is also a star, nor Joan Collins, nor Elizabeth Taylor, who are both older than Edwina, as she informed the jury in the recent libel case in which their names came up and she won. Mrs. Curry also reminded that jury, and therefore the entire nation, that her commons nickname is Vindaloo, because she says she is hot, fresh, spicy, and very enjoyable. Nicholas Hinton is frequently to be seen in the company of the Princess Royal because he is the Director General of Save the Children, of which she, of course, is President. He's one of those high flyers who you would imagine being quite at home, as it were, in the boardroom or in the Cabinet Office, but who's chosen the voluntary sector. Over the last few months, he's been in the forefront of those warning about the unfolding horror of famine in Ethiopia and Sudan. Pressed, but not overwhelmed by the scale of disaster in the Horn of Africa and Bangladesh, his organization has almost 1,000 full-time and part-time staff, works in over 50 countries, including Britain, and has a budget in excess of £50 million a year. Anthony Sampson is a writer and journalist of renown, a doyen among columnists. He's also the author of a stream of successful and influential books in which he has variously anatomized Britain, the oil barons, the arms traders, and the Midas Touch, the name not only of the book, but also of his television series about the seriously rich. Chris Mullin was also a journalist until he became a politician, and the Labour MP whose persistence over 15 years revealed the evidence which finally secured the release of the Birmingham Six. In the course of his campaign, he was widely reviled. The Sun, for instance, once ran a story about him under the illuminating headline, "Loony MP Backs Bomb Gang." Politically, he belongs to the Benite tendency in the Labour Party, and therefore has no hope of early political advancement, a fact which evidently causes him no concern whatsoever. Aside from serving his constituents, it allows him to continue writing political thrillers about conspiracy in high places, and, of course, joining our panel. And could we have our first question, please?
Tony Redmond. I'm not the governor of the Bank of England. I'm a teacher. Can I have a 17.5% pay rise, please?
Kenny, Edwina Curry?
Well, I think I'd like a 17.5% pay rise, wouldn't we all? The governor of the Bank of England wrong-footed himself and the rest of the nation this week, didn't he? And I must say, I do not accept his argument that because he had a 4% pay rise for 2 years before that, and they may add a 22% pay rise the year before those two, that somehow he is entitled to it. I don't think that's on. But what is interesting is that at last the message is getting across to everybody that inflation is at least partly a reflection of the kind of wage rises that we are giving ourselves, and that it's no longer a question of what we deserve to have or what our unions can negotiate for us. It is at least in part a question of what we can afford to pay, because otherwise, as many of these industrial companies are finding, if you pay people more than they are worth and you can't then win the orders from your customers, the next stage is that you're making other people redundant in order to pay for it.
Chris Mullin.
Yes, I've often felt that anybody who's lecturing the nation on what they think other people should earn, postmen and railmen and teachers and the like, should have their salary simultaneously flashed across the screen so that we know where they're coming from. Because it's not just the governor of the Bank of England. There's been a long history of hypocrisy in this area. You'll notice that I think the salaries of directors, according to a recent survey, gone up by between 14 and 47%. Now, those same people are lecturing their workforce on the need for restraint. And if you wish to be taken seriously in life, you really do have to act according to your words and not do something different privately.
Thank you. Nicholas Hinton.
Yes, there's a very good cartoon, I think, in The Independent today, which you may have seen, which shows how people in the city are reacting to the 70% pay rise of the head of the Bank of England. And there's a sort of picture of the City of London, drawing the City of London with its skyscrapers and offices. Then a whole lot of balloons coming out of the office windows. And one of them says, only 17%. Another says, peanuts. Another says, it must mean inflation is running at 17%. And another one, I think, following the a famous remark of a former Tory minister some years ago, said, it's jolly hard now living on £200,000 a year in London. And I think what that cartoon, as all good cartoons does, reflects a much wider concern in society about the difference between pay rises for the workers, as it were, and the bosses, particularly of industry and commerce, and also the very level of these huge six-figure salaries that so many people running industry and commercial concerns appear to have.
Anthony Sampson.
Edwina said that the message is getting through that that inflation just doesn't work. But the fact is, of course, that the governor of the Bank of England and all the company directors that one sees publicized have done nothing whatever to get that message through. They've given everybody the impression that you can, in fact, in the middle of inflation, you can double your own salary and people won't much mind. I think the original questioner, I think, has a very important point, because teachers, particularly now in the political climate, are accepted as having an absolutely critical role in improving the educational system of the country. All three parties, or however many parties there are, all agree that education is a top priority. I don't believe myself we're going to improve our education without paying teachers more. Well, that immediately raises the question, who's going to be paid less if they do get 17%, as the questioner suggested, and I think they should, then somebody should get less. And I think the fact is that managers and directors in big companies whose original or present salary has been geared to increasing profits should have to be reduced when those profits go down. We cannot accept that one-sided view of industrial increases.
You raised two thoughts in my mind. I wonder whether you might pick up one or other of them, Anthony. Everyone's been very high-minded about this. If your directors had voted you an increase of 17%, would you say, do you think, no, under no circumstances, I won't touch the filthy stuff?
I'd like to think so. I mean, let's face it, the governor's predecessor, the Gordon Richardson, did accept a much lower salary. Mrs. Thatcher herself, to her credit, actually didn't take her full salary. I think the tradition of self-denial in semi-public positions is a very important one.
Can I ask you, Edwina, perhaps the second thought, you want to say something in any case, which is, how on earth can you ensure that the directors and others, if they shouldn't be taking these large salaries, don't take them? There's no mechanism, is there?
Oh, I think there's an element of inviting public opprobrium. I think, to be fair to some of the announcements that have been made recently, the salaries were decided a couple of years ago, and we only know about them now because they've come into annual accounts that have been published. In other words, that money's been paid. But, for example, if you take Rolls-Royce, which employs a lot of my constituents, they're just in the process of imposing a pay freeze, and it's quite right, too. They need to do this. And I wrote a slightly stroppy letter to the managing director, Sir Ralph Robbins, and I said, you know, it's going to be an awful lot easier to persuade my constituents of your good faith if the chaps at the top have the pay rise as well. And I had a rather sort of frosty note back saying, we are. So good luck to them. I mean, I think that's absolutely right and proper. It makes it much easier to get across the difficulties that sometimes the businesses face.
Chris Mullin.
What I find fascinating is that Mr. Robin Lee Pimperton can't see what the problem is, even though it's been put to him this morning, but isn't this just a teeny wee bit hypocritical? He really can't see what those putting that point to him are on about, and it's a sign, really, of the state we're in, that our masters live on such a different planet from the one that most of the rest of us dwell on.
Which is my cue to remind the Governor of the Bank of England and anyone else listening that any answers follows the Saturday edition of Any Questions. And if he wishes to explain further, I'd be very glad to hear it. The number to ring is 071-580-4411. And can we have our next question, please?
Margaret Simonite, what is the team's opinion, please, on the recent decision by the government to condemn to death three particular breeds of dogs when there have been other vicious types of dogs who have also killed and maimed?
The big dog debate. Anthony Sampson.
Well, I think it's a bit late myself. I think it's a very, very difficult problem, and I'm bound to say that I think the recent, particularly the one case, but many other recent cases are horrific and shouldn't have been allowed to have happened at this stage. After all, Britain, being an island, does have a particular ability to control the inflow of dangerous creatures of one kind or another. And I simply cannot be persuaded that many of these breeds are not dangerous. It would have been very much easier, of course, to have made the control some time ago. But personally, I think that the controls do have to be pretty drastic. If putting them away is the only solution, then it has to be so. I'm not sufficiently informed to know whether it is the only solution. But I think we've got to face up to it. We can't really pretend that we're going to prepare to put animals ahead of people.
I think that what might have been in our questioner's mind was that why single out three? Why not all dangerous dogs or none, because all dogs can be dangerous?
Yes, that is true. There's been Alsatians, to name one, Rottweilers, Dobermans. We've all killed.
And you'd be prepared to see them dealt with in the same way?
Well,
I just
wondered, really, why they distinguished, you know, between the different breeds.
Nicholas Hinton?
Well, I certainly support the government's action in banning the import of all dangerous dogs. Clearly, the problem is defining what a dangerous dog is, and it's also a problem what you do about those dogs already here. Seems to me a slightly more sensible solution might be to have a kind of amnesty from now until, say, a month's time, when owners of particularly dangerous breeds were asked, as it were, to hand their dogs in. And I wouldn't mind if they were paid some form of compensation for that as well. But I think dogs in general cause problems not just through dangerousness. I live in the middle of an inner city in London, acutely aware of the problems that dogs bring there in all sorts of ways, but particularly in fouling the pavements and so on. And I'd like, well, if the government is minded to be looking at the dogs in general, for greater controls to be enforced by the owners of dogs at a local authority level as well. I think New York's got all sorts of problems. One of the joys of New York is seeing often quite sort of grown-up men walking around with what I think are called pooper scoopers behind their animals, because indeed it is illegal, at least in Manhattan, to allow your dog to foul the neighborhood. I wish that could be introduced here.
Chris Mullin.
I think that action on this, as everybody knows now, has been long overdue. But one of the dangers when you've left something till it's far too late is then overreacting. And I am against killing those dogs already here. I think there's a whole range of measures that could be taken to deal with the problem, but I am against, and I will not vote for killing the dogs already here. But there's a list of things I would vote for, and indeed have been pressing for some time, that dangerous dogs be muzzled when they're in public, that they be neutered to stop more breeding, certainly support the ban on imports, and a register of all dogs, so that dog owners, irresponsible dog owners, will now, and not all dog owners are, and I don't seek to allege that, but will start acting sensibly. And I also agree it shouldn't be confined just to the breeds that have been named.
On the muzzling question, how do you define dangerous dogs? Because quite corgis can bite children in the face. Quite serious point, they can. How do you define what's dangerous and not if you're going to muzzle them in public?
Well, I guess you look at those that cause most of the terrible incidents that we've recently witnessed and start with them and work downwards.
Thank you. Edwina Curry.
I think it's marvellous what the government is going to do. The reason for tackling these particular dogs is they're bred for fighting. And it's not, dogs apparently don't have DNA. There isn't sort of defined breeds as such. And it's rather too easy to crossbreed them and so on. That's in fact happened with some of these particular breeds. But it was absolutely right to say, that's it. No more importation of these dogs as from immediately. I can't see Chris's point about the dogs that are here. Is he saying that they're not going to attack anybody? These dogs are totally unpredictable. They're trained to fight. They're very aggressive. I've seen the Japanese Tosa puppy, the one that was imported recently. And it's only 8 months old. It's as big as a horse already. It's absolutely gigantic. And it was as docile as anything in the television studio where we happened to be. But we showed it a toy dog behind the scenes and it went for it.
You're so very docile in television studio.
Yeah. But it's... let me just pursue it. The pit bull terriers, for example, once they take hold, they can't let go. They actually can't let go. And they bring a pressure of 2,000 pounds per square inch on whatever they're holding on to, whether it's a child, whether it is another dog, whether it is their owner, as it frequently is. Many of the people that are injured by these animals are people in the same families. I think it is not just criminal, but it is insane for somebody to have a dog like this as a pet in their home when they have children, they have neighbours and all the rest of it. That's got to stop, and that is going to stop immediately. Now, I take the point about other dogs. The questioner is absolutely right. We changed the law in 1989. We clearly didn't change it enough. And new legislation will come in, which will enable magistrates not to have to wait till something nasty happens, but will be able to order, for example, the muzzling of dogs, which has never happened in this country before, immediately. And I think we probably share a view that if there is any problem, if there's any doubt, we should take no chances, and these dogs should be put down.
There's a question being raised about whether it's going to be, in practice, enforceable. How are you going to, if there are these 10,000 dogs, and people don't want to have their dog put down, how on earth is it actually in practice going to be done? Do you ever thought about that?
Yes. Neighbours, watch out. I think that's part of the answer. As for an amnesty, that's effectively exactly what they're getting, because this legislation will come through, and the leader of the Labour Party, not perhaps Chris Smullyan himself, but the leader of the Labour Party has indicated that there will be all-party support for legislation, in which case these owners are on notice. They've got to get rid of these dogs by exporting them again or having them put down themselves.
And I think the question about enforcement, this is unrealistic. I mean, the fact is, we all know from some of the horrific stories about how people treat children, how difficult it is to enforce that, and how little neighbours know about that, how often some of these hideous stories of child abuse are unknown or unenforced by the community.
Yeah, but that
the idea that, well, the danger is always in this discussion that people put animals more ahead of people. We've got to face the fact it's hard enough to actually to run a really civilized society for people without unleashing into the middle of it really dangerous animals, which are going to make immensely difficult to enforce. And we know that probation officers and welfare workers find it very difficult, as it is, to enforce these conditions of people.
I really don't agree. I don't think it's going to be that difficult to enforce at all. And if there are any difficulties, well, frankly, that's not an excuse for doing nothing. We must get on with this.
Yeah, but that's why we have to face the problem much more basically. We have to.
Chris Mullin.
All the points that Edwina made were made during the recent debate we had about a year ago, I think, on the need to register dogs. Can I just ask Edwina how she voted on that issue?
I don't think registering dogs will make a scrap of difference.
Thank you very much.
No,
thank you.
Thank you. Frankly, I couldn't care less whether we have a registration scheme for dogs. That seems to me to be a matter of some detail. The RSPCA wants a registration scheme for dogs because they want to run it. In France, dogs have to be tattooed, and so they're easily identified. So I don't think that's the issue. Registering a dog is not going to stop it being a nasty dog. The key thing is to stop them being nasty and indeed to get them out of people's homes and to get them into the zoos where they belong.
Thank you very much. I want to go to our audience on this for a straw poll. By no means an audience supplied by any of those agencies which say they can balance everyone perfectly. It is the people of this area who are here. But what is your view about the question, which is the decision by the government to, in the questioner's words, condemn to death these breeds of dog? Those who believe that's correct, would they be kind and put their hands up? Those who are against, Formby, as represented here, is on the side of the government on this issue. Thank you, and we'll go on to our next question.
Sheila Williams. Michael Heseltine has announced a competition in which major cities are invited to submit plans for regeneration of their inner city areas. Is this really the best way of revitalizing our inner cities? Wouldn't a dependable investment of government money in housing, and especially in manufacturing industry, lead to a more soundly based recovery?
Nicholas Hinton.
Yes, it's sort of here we go again. I mean, I think it's part of the problem of coming back to do the job that you did X years ago. You've got to try and find a way of doing the same thing in a slightly different way. I agree with the questioner. I don't think that a competition among, I think it is 15 different inner city areas, is the way to make any lasting, tangible, and much needed improvement to a lot of our inner city areas. It seems to me almost flippant, frankly, and not to be addressing the problem seriously, as we would expect, especially from a Secretary of State who has been round the course before. An additional point that I don't like, too, is that apparently this is what I think is called in Whitehall old money. No additional resources are being made available at all. It is simply taking a part of the money that's already been voted by Parliament for inner-city regeneration and dressing it up in this rather fancy and, as I say, rather flippant competition.
Thank you. Anthony Sampson.
I also think it was a frivolous and essentially unhelpful suggestion. Liverpool, which I've spent a bit of time in the last 2 years, I think is an interesting example, really, because there you have, I believe, a city centre which is potentially one of the most beautiful and magnificent centres in Britain. And the idea that investment is naturally going to build that centre up is quite absurd, I think. I think the idea of a competition is really actually fudging the issue. The fact is, what Liverpool needs, like other cities which have suffered through no reason of their own from the whole change of trade and the movement of money, they need an immensely purposive, dynamic leadership in the city itself, which is absolutely clear what it is trying to do, and which has the support of more than the accidents of immediate investment. The fact is that Liverpool, like other northern cities, was built with immense pride, with tremendous leadership, with an enormous sense of what it was trying to be and do. And you have to return to that in order to create a really effective and impressive city centre. You need confidence, you need real leadership, you need proper mayors who've got real forces behind them, and you've got to have money being directed. To me, the greatest tragedy that Liverpool had was when Martin's Bank was bought by Barclays Bank and the money flowed south. Unless you can bring the money back into the city, you won't get that support coming to the people.
A flippant idea or an imaginative device? Edwina Curry.
I think it's a good idea, and I'd like to see what sort of schemes the various cities do come up with. But it's worth pointing out that many of the fine buildings in Liverpool, like the Liver Building in Cunard and so on, were actually provided by private money. They were provided as major headquarters of international businesses, and the great shame, I entirely agree with Anthony, is that these places abandoned the city of Liverpool and went off elsewhere and didn't do themselves any good at all in the process. But if you take somewhere like Birmingham, where I was a city councillor for 11 years, I think Anthony's actually quite right. If you have strong city government, with people who come from the place, who love it, who feel committed to it, who are in business there, who work there, then you start to get things moving. And in the city of Birmingham, especially once it had got rid of the county authority and started to govern itself, things really started to happen. So now they've got the opera there, they've got Doyley Carp, they've got the ballet, they've got theatre, and that city really does look something. Very, very little of that was directed from central government. Some of the money came from central government, but it came from people who cared about their city. The great city-states of Europe, the French and German cities, for example, I think are actually quite good models for us. And I personally would like to see directly elected city mayors. I don't feel that any city mayor in my area would be a threat to me. I think it's somebody that I could work with to make sure that what goes on in my area would be satisfactory.
Chris Mullin.
Yes, I think that, like so much else associated with Michael Heseltine, it's a gimmick. Sunderland, the town I live in and represent in Parliament, for example, has had £200 million worth of what we used to call rates of port grants, central government funds, withdrawn over the last decade. And only a reversal of that, all other inner cities suffer the same problem, only a reversal of that is going to make any difference. And I agree with the question, it'll have to be sustained and over a long period of time. It's no good inviting 15 or 10 local authorities to throw dice for 75 million. It's really a waste of time.
Can I put to you just one thought that Edwina Curry didn't mention, which is that perhaps it is a way of concentrating the minds very well in those areas, that they come up with schemes that can be judged to be useful ways of using that money?
Well, they've only given them 6 months or 8 weeks to do it. Now, no serious development that's intended to stand the test of time can be designed and put forward in that length of time. That is truly ludicrous.
Nicholas Hinton?
Yes, I think one good thing, since we've been quite sort of critical of Mr. Heseltine's initiative, one good thing is that I think a condition of the schemes is that there should actually be a partnership between business, local industry, individual voluntary organisations, community groups, local government, central government itself, and members of the community as individual volunteers. But that concept of all those groups working together for the benefit of the community, I think, is a good one. Not a new one, it's a good one. This, just 2-3 days ago, Save the Children opened a new children's centre in a very run-down estate in inner London. And it represented an achievement of all those different groups working together. And it's far the better for that.
Thank you. Edwina?
I was just going to add, if a city like Liverpool wants private money to come back in, If they want business again to have confidence in that city, then they're going to have to sort themselves out. It won't do to have city council employees on strike. It won't do to have the dustbins not collected. It won't do to neglect the old people, to try and close the schools and everything else that's going on in that city. That, in the end, will just add to the decline of what was once Britain's greatest port.
But that's putting the cart.
Andrew Sampson.
That's putting the cart before the horse, because I believe a great deal of that politics comes from a sense of pessimism, a lack of confidence, and the feel of almost despair. And it's only when you can reverse that.
Thank you very much. And we're going to our next question, please.
Ron Bell, what advice would the panel give to any politician thinking of taking a libel action?
Norman Tebbit's been at one end, Edwina Curry's been at the other, as it were. Chris Mullin, what would your advice be?
Don't. Our lawyers are very greedy. They sometimes tell us we've got the best lawyers in the world. We haven't. We've got the greediest. And they're the main beneficiaries of libel actions. Also, I think people in public life in particular, I didn't realise until last week that Edwina was such a sensitive flower, but people in public life in particular are not entitled to be surprised about what's said about them. And sticks and stones can break my bones, but names can never hurt me. I've got my loony MP-backed bomb gang front page of The Sun framed on my wall in the living room.
This is an undertaking, Chris, that under no circumstances will you ever take out a libel action.
Yes, I think I could say that.
That is really open
confidence.
House for anyone, then. Thanks. Nicholas Hinton.
I think public figures should be able to, because I think they are, they run the risk very often of very acrimonious and nasty attacks by a whole range of people. But I don't think they should do it nearly as frequently as some of them do now. I believe that the case that Mr. Tebbit has been involved in has come to a conclusion today. And I read some report of it, and it is quite extraordinary. I mean, he really oughtn't to get involved again. I mean, takes a positive delight in having been called a semi-house-trained polecat by Michael Foot, or indeed when walking down the corridors of the House of Commons wearing a raincoat loosely draped over his mouth, absolutely delighted that Mr. Healy apparently said to him, "Bring on the garlic, here comes Dracula." So... yes, okay, they are more thick-skinned, but I think at the end of the day, they should have the right to protect and defend themselves, if really necessary, but not nearly as frequently as they do.
But I'm right, am I not, Edwina Curry, that in this case, Norman Tebbit was in the dock, as it were.
Yeah, Norman Tebbit was the one who was defending himself. He was sued by David Bookbinder, who is the original Loony Left version of what goes on up in Derbyshire. He's the leader of the Derbyshire County Council, and he sued Mr. Tebbit for saying that it was a foolish idea to have a nuclear-free zone because the Russians wouldn't know the difference. Remember, this was during the Cold War. And while he was at it, he'd wasted £50,000 overprinting
Edwina,
all our stationery.
Edwina, notwithstanding the decision in today's case, can I remind you that this is a broadcast program and the BBC is not only not responsible for what you say. Carry on.
Well, you see, Mr. Bookbinder did the suing, and Mr. Bookbinder lost. That's the whole point. And the only thing that worries me is I'm not sure whether Mr. Bookbinder's doing it in his own right or as the leader of the county council, in which case I know he's going to be paying all those legal fees. And that's
advice,
what bothers me.
Edwina,
what's my advice?
What's your advice? Was it a good idea that you did it, given all the publicity, the tension we all read about, the suspenders and the rest? It's a wonderful read, but was it? Are you glad you did it?
I'm jolly glad I won it, I must admit. I think there has to be a point sometimes where even people in public life, particularly if they are taken to task by newspapers, over which we have no power, there is no power whatever to make a newspaper apologise. Even the various watchdog systems that we've set up, really, they've got no teeth whatsoever. And we are going to have to consider, and I would be reluctant to do so, changing the law to say that a newspaper must give a right to reply and that a newspaper must apologise. And it doesn't happen like that at the moment. And, of course, it's also worth pointing out that these libel actions are really only available to, you know, people with means. If the headmaster here, for example, a distinguished gentleman, was libeled in a local newspaper, it's not really that easy or possible for him to get redress. And I don't think that's fair. I think it ought to be possible to do it outside the High Court in the county claims level.
How do you know he hasn't got the same means as you've got? Oh, he's hasn't got the 17.5%, of course. Anthony Sampson.
I'm against all this suing. I think it's a very bad disease. It's catching. It's getting much more serious. And large part of the reason, I think, is that politicians and other public people take the press far too seriously. I don't think the ordinary readers take the press seriously. I think, alas, they've learnt to realize that newspapers are extremely unreliable and often quite frivolous. But politicians are, with some notable exceptions, of course, are vain people and very touchy, and so, I have to say, are journalists themselves. And nothing is worse than to see a journalist suing another journalist, because that is the real example, I think, of somebody who is living in an enormous greenhouse, glass house, throwing stones and then not being able to take the stones back. My own belief is that the danger now is that, despite what Edwina Curry says, is that actually libel is becoming an extension of show business. The people are enjoying it far too much. You get these tremendously publicized cases, all the way from Kojak to Sir Peregrine Westhorn. People absolutely loving the whole business, being reported much too heavily. And in fact, it's becoming less and less serious business, except, of course, that the lawyers make an enormous amount of money, and the actual libel is almost forgotten in the course of the show.
Edwina?
I love the story about Harold Macmillan, when Ed Muskie pulled out of the presidential race in, I think it was 1962, because he'd been very, very upset about the things that had been said about his wife, who was an alcoholic. And Macmillan was asked, as they were flying back from the States, whether he'd ever been upset about anything like this. And he said, no, 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 no. And the journalist said, well, supposing somebody had said that your wife was an alcoholic, how would you have felt? And Macmillan said, I should have said, you should have seen her mother.
And we'll go on to our next question, please.
Vin McMullen. Does the panel agree that since third world charities are in the business of conquering world poverty, this must imply campaigning on the political front against the causes of poverty?
Third world charities and political activity. Nicholas Hinton.
Well, it's a subject that's been much in the news recently, and I think frequently misunderstood. The Charity Commissioners, the body that oversees the affairs of charities in England and Wales, has for many years had a reasonably, at least, clear-cut view as to how charities should be guided in these matters. And the view is that, take a charity like, say, the Children Fund, our objects as an organisation are to promote the welfare of children here and in many other countries around the world. If we wish to take what might be called a secondary action, which you might call campaigning, in pursuit of those main objects, that is legitimate, that is allowed. But it is not allowed for us to campaign without our objects as an organisation. So, for example, let's take a UK example. If there was a threat to reduce or abolish child benefit in this country, and Save the Children could quite legitimately and understandably take the view that this would be to the detriment of children in the UK, and particularly poor children, the ones that Save the Children works with primarily, then it would be quite appropriate for us to inform the government and others and our supporters that we thought that this line of action by the government was not in the interests of the children of Britain. If you want to call that campaigning, which is a slightly emotive word, do. But that is the position. And as I say, I think frequently misunderstood, both by the public and by often many charities themselves. Common sense is also required, I think, by people that run and administer charities.
Thank you very much. Chris Mullin.
I accept that you've got to draw the line somewhere, but if you're, for example, trying to help people in Cambodia, you are obliged to notice that your government, and indeed most of the Western governments and China, are sustaining the Khmer Rouge, which is the very cause of the misery that you're attempting to alleviate. You can't not notice it, and you'd be less than human if you didn't remark upon it. And the reason Oxfam was recently taken to the Charity Commissioners was because they were remarking upon it, and the government didn't like that. But I accept, as I say, you've got to draw the line somewhere, but I can't see how the two things can't be linked together.
Christian Aid has also come under fire from some politicians for taking a very public stand about apartheid. Does that come this side or that side of the line for you?
Well, it comes in the same category as Cambodia. If you dump millions of people, if you're dealing with the government's dump millions of people in the middle of the veldt and left them to get on with their lives as best they can, and you're trying to alleviate that, you can't not notice the cause of the original problem and be taken seriously.
Edwina Curry.
There has to be a dividing line between charity work and politics, and it has to be a strict one. I think many of us have felt that the charity commissioners have been a bit lax. I mean, they don't seem to have done very much about these abuses. I think it's Oxfam that have been criticised on numerous occasions. And there are practical reasons why there should be a dividing line. Very, very good practical reasons. Reason number one, for example, is there are often different ideas about how to resolve the problems. There may be different political groups within an area, and you're in terrible danger if you start taking one side or another. You've got the additional problem that a charity that starts getting associated with a particular type of group, a political group, may find it can't get into areas that desperately need its help. And that's why the Red Cross can always get in. But I think charities also have to be very politically astute and very aware of what's going on. When I was in Bangladesh, for example, last autumn, and we went to see some of the aid projects, it was more than apparent that a lot of the money wasn't getting to the aid projects. It was getting siphoned off and skimmed off at every single stage. I suspect an awful lot of it ended up in Swiss bank accounts, and that's something that the charities have got to tackle as well.
Just to focus on the question, if you take briefly, Khmer Rouge, apartheid, and what Nicholas Hinton was talking about, domestically, the abolition or the running down of child benefit, are you saying when you talk about abuses, do you regard all those three as abuses of the proper role of charity or not?
Many of the charities active in this country will take a view on something like child benefit, but they don't take a party political view. I mean, some of us will make those sort of cases to our own government. And it's very helpful to be well-informed and to have the sort of information that some of the groups are able to provide. But I do think it's highly dangerous for them to take a view on the politics of other countries. It isn't as easy to take a clear view on what's going to succeed. I mean, in my view, the South African government is now making big strides towards getting rid of apartheid and doing what it can to improve its own economy. It's got to. It has no other place to go but forward. But I don't think it's helped by political activists who are being paid for out of the charity donations of people in this country.
But I think
Anthony Sampson.
This is an example of what I find worrying is the party political element here. Because, of course, it's true that charities of any kind, including perhaps particularly on poverty, are tempted, some people in them are tempted to become too political, in the sense a lot of people, young people, like to make a song and dance about political purposes instead of getting on with the job. That's endemic to all organizations of that kind. And that's a great pity, of course. But that's made much worse, I think, by the fact that in the last 10, 20 years particularly, poverty itself has become part of a political question, which it didn't used to be. There's an idea, once now that you go on about poverty, whether in this country or the third world, that you are taking a party political argument. And therefore, that makes it much harder for people to be candid about what's really going on, what's wrong, because people get aligned. And the whole problem, for instance, of the underclass, both in the United States and here, has become politicized in the sense that once you talk about it, you're assumed to be on the left, if not on the far left, by going on about the hardships in certain parts of the country. That's part of the problem. In fact, the South African question, I believe, has become much, or should be, much more depoliticized. But now the battle lines have been formed and people still go on through reflexes without getting down to the fundamental question of what you do for the vast proportion of the population.
Nicholas Hinton.
Very briefly, 2 points in response to two things that Edwina said. She blames the Charity Commission. Unfair. The government brought forward legislation in the form of white paper, which was to be included in the current session, and it's failed to get it included. That would have added resources to the Charity Commission and powers to the Charity Commission. So I'm afraid it's the government that hasn't given sufficient priority to this question. Secondly, I really can't let you get away with saying that you suspect that aid is going astray from a visit to Bangladesh. It's an unsubstantiated remark, and it's just the kind of thing that makes organizations like Save the Children's Job in this country much, much more difficult.
Edwina Curry.
I just felt very uneasy. I think all the delegation that went felt very uneasy. We saw good work, but we didn't see as much as we were told was being spent on it, and that's what worried me. And I have to say to Nick, I mean, you know, Save the Children is a marvellous charity, and I hope people do support it. I think it does first-class work all over the place. It did work in Birmingham. I did work with it when I was a councillor there, and we set up a nursery and so on. Excellent work. But don't be naive. The countries you're working in, the smooth, smiling faces that you're dealing with in some of these countries are taking that money. And it is absolutely essential that the good charities make sure that the money goes where it is needed and where it is intended.
Just let's get clear. Are you saying, I presume you're not saying that Nicholas Hinton is naive given his experience on the ground in these places. You're saying, who are you asking not to be naive about it? Are you telling Nick not to be naive, in which case I expect you want to come back in?
I think it is widely recognised that there is corruption in a lot of these countries, and it's a heartbreaking business. You go into a project where people are in desperate need, you see some money's been spent. You then go into the presidential palace, and you can see a hell of a lot of money's been spent. That's what bothers me.
But I think we're just feeding a whole lot of stereotypes about people's myths about the third world.
I saw it.
All right. There is not a consensus on that point. We will go on to our next question.
Les Page. Does the panel agree with the view recently expressed by Norman Tebbit, the Bishop of Durham, and Tony Benn that the Church of England should be disestablished?
Disestablishmentarianism on the agenda. Chris Mullin, do you agree with Tony Benn?
One bit of privatisation I would support, actually. Yes, as you know, the Church of England is often referred to, whether fairly or not, I don't know, as the Conservative Party at prayer. And I think that's very unfair on the Church of England. And the further they can distance themselves from the Tory party, the higher their street credibility will be.
Anthony Sampson.
Well, I think Mrs. Thatcher did more bishop bashing than almost anybody has done in history, and I don't think myself was very helpful, because on the whole, I think the bishops are on the side of good and decency and civilised values, and I don't think it's particularly helpful to depict them as being basically feeble wets who are simply wasting public funds, which was, I think, the general build-up in the 80s. I think myself there's a strong case for disconnecting further if there's much more disconnecting to do. Of course, it's now basically a financial question. And, of course, the Church of England is already pretty poor. Exactly what kind of accommodation you reach around the financial side is very difficult to say. But nobody can now, I think, particularly after the 80s, nobody can think in the same way that the Tory party is the Church of England of prayer or vice versa. I think that link has been much more broken. And I think it'd be actually rather helpful to the Church if it was further broken.
Edwina Curry.
I suspect our former Prime Minister regarded the Church of England as being substantially the SDP at prayer, with a little bit of the soft bit of the Labour Party as well. The link is broken, that's right. I personally couldn't care less whether it's established or disestablished or what. What I would like is to see, first of all, other churches and religious denominations better represented, particularly in the House of Lords, for example, where there are 26 bishops. There's one former chief rabbi. There's one Methodist, there's one Muslim lady. It's absolutely ridiculous. The heads of our various religious denominations in this country should be members of the House of Lords absolutely automatically. Cardinal Hume should be there right now, for example. It's all wrong that the only strong voice that's heard is from one particular sect, from one particular religion in such a diverse country.
Thank you. And Nicholas Hinton.
Yes, I think it was called the SDP at prayer. I hope it doesn't go the same way as the SDP. On balance, I think it would be a good idea to disestablish the Church of England. I think it would help bring a new lease of life into the Church that, in my view, it badly and urgently needs.
You're speaking as the son of a vicar?
Son of a rector.
Son of a rector, I beg your pardon. Chris, you want to come back in again?
Correct me if I'm wrong, but doesn't the Prime Minister appoint the bishops of the Church of England? Yeah. So there's rather more than just the financial link that Anthony Sampson referred to. That's really a rather direct link. I don't know how the Bishop of Durham slipped through the net, but...
And at that point, we have to come, unfortunately, to the end of this week's edition of Any Questions. Next week, we are going to be in Falmouth, where the panel will be John Bannum, who's Director General of the Confederation of British Industry, Frank Dobson, Labour MP for Holborn and a member of the Shadow Cabinet, Melanie Phillips, who's policy editor of The Guardian, and Anne Widdecombe, the Conservative MP and junior minister at the Department of Social Security. Join us then, but from here in Formby, from our panel and from our audience. Goodbye.
Any questions came from Formby and Merseyside. In the team were Edwina Curry, MP, Nicholas Hinton, Chris Mullin, MP, and Anthony Sampson. Jonathan Dimbleby was in the chair, and the producer was Nick Utekin.